It's Christina Martini and Rich Linkov. You know what time it is. Welcome to Legal Face-Off. Two lawyers trading jab for jab. So hit them up with any questions you have. WGN Radio, we blowing up your stereo. Got a question, just pick up the phone and they'll let you know. Covering sports, Hollywood, and don't forget the politics. It don't get no better than this, nah. Courtroom combat going hand to hand. Two masters of the trade, conversation hot, you need a fan. It's Legal Face-Off, so step into the ring. No topic off limit, cause they gon' cover everything. Now check them out on Facebook and Twitter. Like and follow because we don't wanna miss ya. Introducing your host, Christina and Rich. Legal Face-Off is about to begin, yeah. Welcome to Legal Face-Off.
And we welcome you into Legal Face-Off on WGN. It is the final episode of Legal Face-Off in the month of November. Thanksgiving is over, and Rich Linkov, Tina Martini back in town. My name is Sam Paniato. Craig Collins across the glass. Plenty of things to get to per usual. We'll talk about Roy Moore, hazing in America, five myths about white-collar crimes, and Sussler returns for Inside Out, plus the grab bag at the end of the show.
The return of Sussler.
Sussler is back. We cannot get Sussler in studio. We still don't know why or how. We will not ask that question.
Alleged Sussler. We haven't never actually seen
purported Sussler.
Yes, purported Sussler. We join this show with our first guest, though, Brian C. Kalt, who's the professor of law and Harold Norris faculty scholar at Michigan State University's College of Law, and also the author of the book Constitutional Cliffhangers, A Legal Guide for Presidents and Their Enemies. Hello, Professor. Welcome to Legal Face-Off.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Professor, as of this minute, Roy Moore is still in the race. He gave a speech last night about, how the media is attacking him, and this is all made up. So it looks like he is not getting out of the race in Alabama. You wrote a piece in the Wall Street Journal about why, if he wins, that the Senate is stuck with him. Tell us why.
Well, a lot of people have said that if he wins, the Senate shouldn't seat him. They should say that he's distasteful to them and that he's not entitled to the seat. But the Supreme Court had a case very much in this mode, and they said you can't do that. You got the constitutional qualifications. You got to be for the Senate. You got to be 30 years old. You got to be a citizen for a certain amount of time. You got to be a resident of the state. That's it. They can't make up their own qualifications. So if he meets those qualifications and he wins the election, they have to seat him.
So what do you think the likelihood is that he would actually step out? I mean, it's 2 weeks now until the election. There's been a lot going on over the past couple of days. It was reported, for example, that a woman went to the Washington Post falsely claiming that Roy Moore impregnated her. It seems like every day there are at least several stories on Roy Moore. Do you think that there's any chance that at this point he's going to be stepping out of the race?
I think if he thinks that he has a chance to win, that he will keep running. And if he does win, then he can say that the voters had their say, that they didn't believe it. He said it's not true. They agreed. If he loses, maybe he'll still blame the media. But ultimately, it is up to the voters. They've also talked about expelling him, which they can expel for whatever reason they want. That would be that would be a little trickier. Again, what I argued in the article was they tend not to do that for things that the voters knew about. The voters vetted the issue and they decide to send him there. They're not going to expel him for that. They've never done that in the past. They have the power to, but they've never used it because they say it's for things that you do. You expel someone for something they do after the election, something they've done in office, not something they did a long time before that the voters have already said doesn't bother them that much. If the voters do say that.
How would the expulsion process work if we went down that path?
Well, someone would, one of the senators would introduce a resolution to expel him. It would go to a committee. They would investigate. They would decide what they thought happened. They would make a recommendation to the full Senate. And then the full Senate would vote, and you would need two-thirds voting to expel in order to expel him. And in the past, they have not, they've not taken those cases very far if it's about something that happened before the person was even a senator. So they would need 66 votes. It's two-thirds. He probably wouldn't vote in his own case, so they'd need 66 out of the remaining 99 to expel him. And it's hard to get 66 senators to agree on anything, especially something like that where they're saying anything you've done in the past is fair game. If the media turn against you and you get 66 votes, they're going to be very reluctant to open the door to that.
Well, especially as you point out in the article, in light of allegations against other sitting members of Congress, including Al Franken, right? I mean, if you go down this road, then what's to stop expulsion against Al Franken, who is now the subject of allegations from many women? There's also been talk, notably by Gloria Allred, who represents some of the alleged victims, who's a frequent guest on Legal Face-Off, to call Judge Moore to testify at a hearing about these allegations prior to the election. How would that process work? And is it even something that you think is practical to be done in the next few weeks?
Well, the Senate can do that, right? They can have hearings about anything they want, and they can bring people in to testify. It seems unlikely to me that the Senate would want to do that, first of all, given that the Senate is controlled by Moore's party. They are probably not interested in doing something like that. The more conventional thing to do would be to let the voters decide. I don't think that Gloria Allred needs the Senate to do that. She can essentially try the case in the media. That's the way it's supposed to work. It's a political decision for the voters to make. If the Senate weighs in, again, as a practical matter, who knows? I mean, there are people in Alabama for whom the opposition of the Republican leadership in the Senate is a reason to vote for Roy Moore. So I'm not even sure that it would help the Allred's case or Doug Jones's case against Moore, even if they did do that.
Quick answer, is Roy Moore the next senator from Alabama?
Oh, I don't know. I never make predictions, especially about the future. But we'll certainly all be watching. And if he wins the election, then yes, he will be.
So you make predictions about the past, though.
A little easier.
Specialty, yeah.
All right. Got you on record there. That's Brian C. Call, professor of law and the Harold Norris faculty scholar at Michigan State University College of Law. Go green, and thanks for joining us.
Go white.
The following information is considered advertising material. You're listening to Christina Martini on Legal Face-Off. Tina is a partner at DLA Piper and focuses her practice on domestic and international trademark and copyright law, as well as domain name, internet, social media, advertising, and unfair competition law. Tina is chair of DLA Piper's Intellectual Property Practice Group in Chicago, and she serves as the firm's national hiring partner for associate recruiting. Tina has received numerous professional accolades, including an AV preeminent rating by Martindale Hubbell, and selected for many years as one of America's leading intellectual property attorneys by various legal publications. In addition to her full-time practice, Tina is a columnist, legal analyst, and podcast host. She frequently shares her thought leadership with respect to current trends impacting both the legal and business landscapes through various media outlets. DLA Piper is a global law firm with lawyers located in more than 40 countries throughout the Americas, Europe, the Middle East, Africa, and Asia Pacific. DLA Piper is positioned to help its clients with their legal needs around the world. To learn more about DLA Piper, please contact Tina or visit DLAPiper.com.
You can find Legal Face-Off on Facebook, on Twitter. You can also find us, of course, on iTunes, where you can leave us a review and rate the show. Joining us now on the phones, Dr. Gregory Parks. He's a professor of law at Wake Forest University School of Law, also the Associate Dean for Research, Public Engagement, and Faculty Development, and a board member at hazingprevention.org. Welcome, Dr. Parks.
Thanks for having me.
Doctor, are we seeing more hazing incidents recently, or are they just getting more attention?
My assumption is that they're just getting more attention. I don't think that they're exponentially or significantly more than they've been in the past 20, 30 years.
Why do you think they're getting more attention, and what do you make of the chances of success of some of the litigation that we've seen, for example, in the Penn State hazing incident?
I'm not sure why it's getting more press. Maybe given the role of social media, news stories travel a lot faster today than they did 30 years ago. About the success of the litigation, go ahead.
Yeah, no, just, you know, what are your thoughts generally on the litigation that we've seen? I think it is true to say that while hazing might not be on the rise generally, I think the lawsuits surrounding these incidents have been on the rise, or at least they've gotten a lot more attention recently. Again, I think the Penn State is a good example for obvious reasons why we've seen a lot of coverage of this litigation.
Yeah, I don't think there's any more litigation than there has been since, say, like the 1980s, but the litigation has been getting more press. Whether or not they'll be successful is a mixed bag. One thing I will say is that civil litigation, I don't think actually deters hazing. I think the potential of criminal prosecution and ultimately criminally prosecuting individuals for hazing can have a slightly more beneficial effect in reducing hazing.
So what type of hazing do you think tends to be the biggest problem and among which groups? I know you've written and spoken about hazing among BGLOs, which are the Black Greek Letter organizations, for example. To what extent is hazing worse among that group or and other groups than others?
I think hazing is far more severe in fraternities than sororities, at least if we're focusing on fraternities and sororities. Keep in mind, hazing exists in fraternities, sororities, athletics, marching bands, the military. The distinction that I see between, at least when we focus on fraternities and sororities, between organizations that cater largely to racial minority groups and historically white organizations is that in the latter, alcohol use tends to be a far more dominant issue. And the former, physical violence tends to be a bigger issue.
So to what extent do you think that there is a duty on behalf of the universities to protect students from hazing incidents? You know, obviously, now that these incidents have gotten more attention, gotten more press, it would be hard for a university, if they're a defendant, to argue that they had no prior notice of these incidents. Certainly, the universities are being named as defendants in civil lawsuits, as well as the fraternities and sororities themselves, as well as individuals who are involved. From a bigger picture perspective, to what extent do you think the universities do have duties to protect their students from these kind of incidents?
I think they do. Look, if as a parent you're sending your child off to college for 4 years and you're spending $20,000, $40,000, $60,000, then you would like for your child to not end up dead during the course of those 4 years at the institution. And so you should reasonably expect, and as a society we should reasonably expect, that universities do what they can within reason to reduce the likelihood that hazing exists, and certainly reduce the likelihood that individuals are seriously injured or killed because of hazing.
You've written extensively about the solutions or potential solutions to hazing. In that vein, with your, you know, and segueing from the comment you just made, what do you think are some things that can be done, whether it's by university or otherwise, to combat hazing? And what has worked of the solutions that you've seen that have been tried and implemented? What has worked and what hasn't?
So one thing we've got to keep in mind about solutions is that hazing is a very complex problem, and that there are probably hundreds of reasons why it exists and persists, so there's no silver bullet that's going to solve it. You have to figure out where your points of intervention can be, or large groups of areas in which your intervention will be most effective. One thing I've found in some of my research is that individuals who have better risk appraisal, meaning that they understand the risks associated with hazing, are less likely to engage in it on the part of both being the hazing victim and the hazer. So one way to get at that is more meaningful and robust education amongst members of organizations and prospective members. Some of the onus clearly should be on college campuses. Some of the onus should be on the organizations themselves. But that education has to be consistent with research on effective teaching and learning. So there has to be deep content there. You have to test individuals to make sure they understand what's taught. And the approach to teaching has to be consistent with what one would do if you actually wanted someone to learn something, as opposed to simply covering your behind. So that's one approach.
Doctor, in addition to being a professor of law, you've got a PhD in clinical psychology. So I feel like this is an appropriate question for you. To what extent do you think, you know, or maybe not the rise in hazing, but the degree of hazing that we're seeing is a result of the overall coarsening of society that we're seeing? And listen, I don't want to turn this political, but certainly we see our chief executive, the president, you know, almost on a daily basis going after people personally, attacking people, calling their names. Do you think that has led or helped lead to a sort of degradation of norms such that it's okay now in people's eyes to pick on people? Because let's face it, hazing is just a form of bullying. So, you know, if you're a 16-year-old, 18-year-old, and you see the president calling out people for racial, ethnic reasons, do you think that leads to people feeling like I can engage in hazing with little or no consequence?
I think that might be part of it, but a very small part of it. You know, keep in mind, like I said, hazing is a very complex human behavior, and there are likely hundreds of reasons why. So even if that's a reason, it may be a fraction of a percentage. Back to another point that was raised, so hazing, at least when we look in fraternities and sororities or in other institutions and organizations, it tends to be far more extreme amongst men. So there's something about being a man and the types of hazing that we see that's deeply problematic. But also to my point about hazing being far different, at least in fraternities and sororities, amongst racial minority groups and historically white groups. So there's some intersectional dynamic there, intersection of race and gender, that we've got to unpack. So, you know, I was actually just looking at a group of books I had on my shelf that got delivered from my law library on white masculinity. And you've got to figure out what is it that makes young white males, just focusing on them for a second, engage in hyper-masculine behavior around excessive alcohol use and what redounds from that, particularly in the context of fraternity culture.
That's Dr. Gregory Parks, Wake Forest University School of Law, and a board member at hazingprevention.org. We appreciate your time here on WGN.
And thank you, guys. Take care.
The following information is considered advertising material. You're listening to Rich Lenkoff on Legal Face-Off. Rich is a partner at Bryce Downey & Lenkoff and handles workers' compensation, general liability, and entertainment law. He's been selected to the 2017 Illinois Super Lawyer List and has been named leading lawyer from 2012 through 2017. Rich has been honored as one of the 50 most influential people in workers' compensation by SEEK Incorporated, and is a frequent lecturer for many national organizations. Rich also is the legal analyst for The Bill and Wendy Show and Pretty Late with Patty Vasquez on WGN. Bryce Downey & Lenkoff is a full-service law firm in Illinois and Indiana. Among their other practice areas are business litigation, construction, employment law, insurance coverage, intellectual property, and professional liability. To contact Rich and to learn more about Bryce Downey & Lenkoff, visit bdlfirm.com/WGN.
It's time to talk about white-collar crimes, a great piece in the Washington Post written by Nicholas Borton, who's a partner at Sullivan & Cromwell LLP. Also, he spent 4 years as an assistant U.S. attorney in the Eastern District of New York, as we welcome him on to Legal Face-Off on WGN. Thanks for joining us, Nicholas.
Glad to be here. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, very topical piece in light of the Mueller investigation and lots of other news about white-collar crime. You've got 5 myths about white-collar crime. I want to talk about your first one, because we've had a lot of former U.S. attorneys on our show talking about going after very prominent politicians, other prominent defendants. Your first myth is that prosecutors fear prosecuting powerful defendants. We agree that that's a myth, given our experience, but tell us why you think that.
Well, you know, it's funny. This is one of those areas where conventional wisdom is so starkly different from the experience of people who practice in the area. And, you know, the idea that prosecutors are, you know, reluctant or afraid in some way to charge white-collar defendants, I think comes as a surprise to those of us who defend them, who represent companies and their senior executives. I think, you know, there are, you know, armies of state and federal prosecutors out there and lawyers at enforcement agencies who would love nothing better than to make cases against senior executives at some of our biggest companies. And, you know, we see very aggressive tactics, very aggressive factual legal theories when they pursue these cases. And, you know, it can be a hair-raising experience for the people who go through these investigations.
Yeah, I mean, the bigger the defendant, the bigger the get, and not just because you want to self-aggrandize yourself as the prosecutor, but because, more importantly, you want to set an example to others that might be considering the same course of action, right?
That's exactly right. And you would be, you know, fulfilling the policy of your office if you work for the Department of Justice, where, you know, successive deputy attorney generals have, you know, sent out the message quite clearly to their lawyers saying, you know, go out and make cases against individuals. And that's what they're trying to do.
Nicholas, another one of the myths that you write about is that Trump's administration will not enforce anti-corruption laws. Can you tell us a little bit more about that and what the truth is?
Sure. And this would, it's a little difficult to say because of there is such a lag in the bringing of these cases. So this year has seen, you know, robust activity in the area of the Foreign Corrupt Practices Act. And even, you know, post-dating my article, I think it was the following week, the DOJ announced that five senior executives of both Rolls-Royce and a company called SBM Offshore, one of whom I represent, had been indicted on foreign corruption charges. It was pretty notable to have five individual prosecutions, you know, coming out in the same week. And I got a call, you know, from journalists and others were asking, you know, what has changed in the, under the new administration to make the prosecution of five senior executives for corruption like this possible? And the answer is, of course, it nothing has changed. It's a continuation of the policy. And these cases began long ago and will continue. So I think the work of the line lawyers and the case agents who bring these cases, you know, endures and is sort of more important day to day than who's sitting, you know, in the White House or even in senior Justice Department seats.
You also write about financial crime and how it's different from robbery or theft. Can you elaborate on that a little bit? Because I think a lot of people sort of conflate those concepts.
Yeah. And I know there was some passionate reaction to that part of my article, because I think it is sort of a touchy subject for people. The idea of white collar defendants being, you know, thieves in boardrooms as opposed to street corners is a prevalent one. And I don't mean to minimize white collar crime or you know, street crime, but I think the fact is there is a difference in the psychology of white collar crime. It's part of what makes it so fascinating, at least to me. And it's that the people who commit the crime most of the time are very distant from their victims, if their victims can even be identified. And so there's a different psychology when you walk up to someone and you hold them up on the street and you have that physical contact and that proximity to the harm you're causing, as opposed to, you know, sitting in your office and writing something or taking an action on your computer that could potentially affect, you know, sort of nameless, faceless people who you may not even be thinking about.
Nicholas, before we let you go, I got to ask you, I'd be remiss as a lifelong devotee of gangster movies, in particular mafia movies, to not ask you about your extensive history going after the mafia. As assistant U.S. attorney in New York, you convicted over 75 members and associates of La Cosa Nostra, which is just, on our show, fun to say. Do they really mince garlic, cut garlic that closely in prison? Is it really, you know, are these movies really on point? I'm sure the answer is not, but, you know, I assume some of them get it more accurate than others.
Yeah, well, the truth is that when it comes to the facts of what happened, the movies and the TV shows aren't often very accurate. When it comes to the character sketches and the portrayals of the personalities, the Hollywood sort of gets it spot on much of the time. But I think it kind of works in reverse. I think you end up seeing the gangsters imitating the movies as much as the movies portraying the gangsters.
Interesting stuff there. That's Nicholas Borton, a partner at Sullivan & Cromwell, LLP, in the piece in the Washington Post, Five Myths About White-Collar Crime. We really appreciate you coming on. Thank you.
Thank you for having me.
We wrap up the show on Legal Face-Off with Rich and Tina and Sam. Craig Collins doing a great job behind the glass. We tag in David Sussler, one half of the Inside Out team from Chicago Lawyer Magazine. He's, of course, the Associate General Counsel at National Material LP. It's been a while, David. I haven't talked to you. I think I missed the last episode you were here, so welcome back officially.
You did.
Yeah, well, I apologize.
You guys want some time to get reacquainted?
Actually, you guys can just leave. Yeah, we'll just leave the studio. David and I are going to talk about Springsteen. All right, so the latest piece in Inside Out is called Playing the Game. Tina, do you want to lay it out, Playing the Game?
Yes, it's about office politics and how you can be on the better side of office politics rather than having your office become Game of Thrones, which is one of David's favorite shows.
None of that happens here at Legal Faceoff, by the way. There's no inter-office politics because we actually don't have an office. But that being said, David, you work in an office with other human beings. What are some misperceptions, first of all, about office politics?
Well, I think that, you know, people think it's like a kill or be killed type of setting, which just isn't true. It's not all manipulation and backstabbing or dirty game playing. It can actually be an enjoyable process where you get to be friendly and cooperative colleagues.
Even with lawyers, though? Lawyers are notoriously backstabby, right? I mean, you're in... You know, you're inside counsel. Let's talk about outside counsel. Tina Martini, you work in a big office, multinational law firm. You're involved in many different facets of the law firm. There's got to be cliques. There's got to be backstabbing. There's got to be egos involved. How do you, from a management perspective, deal with it?
Well, that's a great question. I think
of
it's just,
it
well, you always
look
ask
how long it
questions.
Was, by the way. It was long. It's got to be great.
You almost answer the question before you even finish asking
it. Go ahead.
You know, it's one of those things where you just have to, I think the key thing is to get a really accurate lay of the land and understand where those, I guess, those factions or those cliques exist. I try not to partake in that, especially as management. It's important for me to get everybody rowing in the right direction and focused on client work. But you have to understand that these factions exist and you have to work around them. And I try to conduct myself in a way that I would like others to conduct themselves, which is with transparency.
So do you think lawyers, to that point, both of you weigh in on this, do you think lawyers are more factitious? Do you think that as a subunit of, you know, workers in the world, lawyers are more involved in office politics and backstabbing than, let's say, people who work in, you know, an office or police officers or people work in a convenience store?
I don't think so.
No.
I think that everybody has this tendency towards being political to advance their own self-interest.
Oh, so
I don't think it's just lawyers.
They're all a-holes everywhere. It doesn't matter if you're a lawyer or not.
Yeah, I don't think it matters. Yeah. David,
right.
What do you think?
No. There's always office politics to be played. Even if you're a one-person business, there's politics to be played with your customers, your vendors, your suppliers, whoever. There's always some sort of office politics, and lawyers are no more inclined or, you know, no more likely to play the game than anybody else. It exists everywhere.
I liked your quote, David, in the magazine about you asked your father for advice, and he said, quote, a little bit of brown nosing never hurt anybody. Too much will kill you. Can you expand upon that?
Yeah. Well, you know, it's funny. When he told me that, I had no clue what he meant because, you know, I just come off of my summer internship, which was my first real job, so to speak, and it took me a long time to figure it out. But what I think it means is, you know, look, there's always somebody higher up in the hierarchy than you are, and you have to treat them with the appropriate respect. And that's okay. Even if you don't like them, you have to treat people with a certain amount of respect. But you also have to know where your ethical line is. You know, you're not going to break the law. You're not going to violate your professional ethics. So you have to know how far are you willing to bend before you need to walk.
Tina, how does social media affect office politics and gamesmanship and the way people treat each other, let's say, in law firms like one that you work in?
That's an interesting question. Are you getting at something in particular, Rich?
No, I'm not.
Social media? Well, I don't know if this is the angle that you want to go with on this question.
If I told you the angle, it wouldn't be Legal Faceoff,
would
it?
It wouldn't be Legal Faceoff.
That's right.
Well, it's interesting. I mean, on social media, you have to be really careful about what you say about coworkers, what you say about your place of employment. I can tell you can learn a lot about your coworkers through how they use social media and the types of things that they say or don't say. It's interesting. Sometimes there's interesting commentary that goes on in workplaces about how active certain people may be on social media and the types of commentary they have. That's why it's really important, for example, to be careful about talking about things like politics, and whether you're a Democrat or a Republican, and also being really careful about what you do with respect to other people's, like, for example, Facebook pages. And what you may say in commentary about them, because that could end up being fodder for office politics as well.
I'd be remiss if we didn't end off inside out, much to Chicago Lawyer Magazine's chagrin, because it has nothing to do with the column, with our Springsteen discussion. I just saw Springsteen on Broadway last week. You both saw it maybe a week or two before. My question deals with office politics, David. What is the best, and I'm going to put David on the spot like I always do, what's the Springsteen song that best describes office politics and people working together? Go ahead. I know you have this.
Oh, my gosh.
Right? You see?
I don't have that
legal
on face tip off. Of my tongue.
I've got one. It's Hungry Heart. Everybody's got a Hungry Heart.
Uh-huh. That's not bad. But the funny thing is, to that point, in the show, Springsteen talks about how his whole career has sort of been a facade because, you know, he grew up like, you know, a few minutes away from Midtown Manhattan, and he talks about working in a factory in his songs. He's never actually seen a factory. So there's lots of songs that he does about working and about maybe office politics, but he's never actually held a job, as he says a million times.
How about Badlands? Old
men
want to be rich. Rich men want to be king.
There you go.
That's fun.
He ain't satisfied till he rules everything.
There you go.
I want to spit in the face of these Badlands.
What about Dancing in the Dark?
Yeah, no, not so much at all. Mine is more direct. Mine is a song called Car Wash, because it's literally about a car wash.
Yeah.
I got to imagine there's a lot of inter-office dynamics when you're working at a car wash. You know, like, you stole my rag, you're trying to get all the good tips, you know, so there you go.
I think this was a great inside out. I think it was so good.
The crowd goes wild.
I'm going to play with this instant replay machine for the rest of time. Thank you, David, for checking in.
Thanks for having me.
Bye, Sussler.
Where can we read the article again? Which edition? November 2017?
It's November 2017.
Inside Out, Chicago
Lawyer Magazine.com.
Very good.
All right. Legal grab bag time on Legal Face Off. Rich and Tina, as we wrap up the show here, high above the seventh floor in the Tribune Tower. We've got seven
not
topics.
Not for long, by the
yeah,
way.
Not for long.
Not for
we
long.
Are moving. Yeah, the new digs.
Where are we
going to
be?
I don't know.
Subterranean, maybe?
Yeah. Lower Wacker, the Lower Wacker Drive Studio. I will let you take it away, Rich, and introduce the first topic.
So, first story is a lawsuit in the Trump administration between who's really running this Consumer Protection Bureau.
Yes, Leandra English, who is the deputy director of the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau, filed a lawsuit against Donald Trump this past Sunday. The lawsuit seeks an injunction against Trump's appointment of Mick Mulvaney, who is currently the director of Office of Management and Budget, as acting director of the CFPB. Leandra English claims that she is the rightful acting director of the agency, because under the Dodd-Frank Act, she is automatically the temporary director of the agency after Richard Cordray's resignation. Trump, on the other hand, claims that he has the authority to appoint the acting director under the Federal Vacancies Reform Act, which authorizes the president to temporarily authorize an acting director of an executive agency whose appointment is made by the president subject to Senate confirmation. The law says it is the exclusive means for naming an acting director unless another statute expressly designates an official to serve. The DOJ's Office of Legal Counsel went on record to say that the Dodd-Frank Act does not displace the authority granted to the president under the statute, and that either statute can be invoked and that the statute should be construed in parallel. So yesterday afternoon, there was an emergency hearing held before the U.S. District Judge Timothy Kelly in Washington, where both sides were given an opportunity to hash it out. And Kelly refrained from ruling and said he would wait until the government attorney supplemented their arguments by filing a more formal written response last night. And he said he would wait until today to issue a ruling.
Yeah, just another reason why it's like the best time in history to be a lawyer in Washington right now, because, you know, you're having administration officials in the same administration suing each other about who's the boss of this agency. And there's politics, obviously, behind this. You know, yesterday, I was watching the press conference, Sarah Huckabee Sanders' daily briefing, and they asked her about it. And, you know, she and Trump had been very critical of this group in the past, saying it was political. It wasn't really meant to protect consumers. And Mick Mulvaney, who's also the head of the OMB, it was pretty unusual for one person to hold two jobs. And she was asked about that yesterday. She didn't have a great answer. So, you know, behind this whole legal fight is politics.
Well, and she also didn't really have a great answer about the Pocahontas issue either.
No, she did not. No.
Lots of non-answers there.
Well, I love how Trump said, some people call her Pocahontas. You mean you, don't you, Trump? Like, he said, you know, when he was talking to the code breakers, that, oh, and some people call her Pocahontas. No, no.
Well, and then he touches the guy on the shoulder and says, you're special.
You're not. Yeah. Just like women are special. Oh, I remember the other day he said, women are very, very special. This is a special time in history to be a woman.
Oh, I'm sure it is.
Great. He's unbelievable. NBC News has a story. The title is pretty grabbing. Big Tobacco finally tells the truth in a court-ordered ad campaign.
So after years and years of appealing the settlement, Big Tobacco has finally aired these commercials that were part of the litigation. After 11 years of, again, appealing the decision or appealing the decision that forced them to tell the truth in these ads, they have finally started to run over the last week. You know, most people remember that there was a Justice Department racketeering lawsuit against Big Tobacco back in 1999, basically trying to get them to pay for decades of deception. In 2006, after 7 years, federal court judge said that they would have to pay for the ads. Now, again, the companies have tied this up for the last 11 years, and now we finally see these ads. And these ads are pretty stark, although I will say that they are adhering to the letter of the agreement. There's really, it's almost like a robotic voice just saying that, you know, smoking will kill you. It says that when you smoke, nicotine actually changes the brain. Secondhand smoke kills over 38,000 Americans per year, etc. So finally, we see the results of this litigation.
Supreme Court getting involved in more cases involving gun restrictions. What's the latest there?
Well, the latest is that the U.S. Supreme Court announced yesterday that it declined to hear two Second Amendment cases in Maryland and Florida, thereby leaving in place the lower court rulings which upheld both of the gun laws at issue. The Florida case, which is Norman v. Florida, involved a challenge to the state's ban on open carry, which extends to those who are licensed to carry a concealed weapon. Dale Norman had challenged the law when he was arrested and fined for brandishing his holster, which was visible as he was walking down the street. He claimed that the law violates his constitutional rights. And in the Maryland case, which is Colby v. Hogan, gun owners had challenged the state's ban on military-style weapons, such as semi-automatic rifles and large-capacity magazines. The Fourth Circuit shot down the argument that this type of gear is covered, stating that the Second Amendment does not extend to weapons of war. So these decisions are actually pretty consistent with a number of other similar decisions in the past, declining to review other similar lower court decisions. So
I'll never understand how these assault weapons are even thought of to be legal. I mean, these are weapons of mass destruction. People won't actually argue that they should be legal.
Yeah, I actually watched a couple of interviews with folks representing the NRA, and they feel very strongly that this is squarely within the Second Amendment, and I don't think that this is something that you will ever get folks to agree on.
Okay.
It's just interesting, and this is always a point that I think is worth making, that it's interesting if you're, you know, a supporter of the Second Amendment, that you are willing to read into the Second Amendment words that aren't there, right? The Second Amendment talks about a well-armed militia, right? Yet the Second Amendment advocates say that that can be extrapolated to say that you have the right to carry a gun. Yet those same people are strict constructionists when it comes to other parts of the Constitution that they don't like very much.
Well, that was, so on that the one was hand, Justice Scalia, as brilliant as he was.
On the one hand, you're saying let's broadly interpret the words of the Second Amendment, yet let's very narrowly interpret the original intent when it comes to other areas. So I just feel the need to point out that hypocrisy.
Well, that's why, you know, Justice Scalia always liked to put, you know, put together a five-pronged test whenever it was convenient for him. God, may he rest in peace.
Don't make me start my Scalia story, which I've told on these airwaves before, when Scalia mocked me in a room full of Federalist Society people because I misspelled precedents. Anyway.
The mooch is back, more importantly.
The mooch. Where's the
Our
mooch been?
Favorite moocher. So,
our favorite 11-day director of communications, you mean?
Well, he's my favorite moocher, too. So anyway, he's
Watch
back.
Out. Don't say that, by the way. I do not support what she just said because we know from the story that the mooch will sue for calling him names. So
we need him on the show, yes. By the way.
Oh, yeah, we
Try
actually
to book
do.
The mooch.
So actually, there are two things that are noteworthy with the mooch. First is that Tufts University decided to postpone Scaramucci's appearance that was originally scheduled for yesterday at the school because he has threatened to sue a Tufts student over an op-ed piece that published in the school's paper.
This I'm saying Tufts, right?
Tufts.
Not Tufts.
No, Tufts.
Got it.
Yeah, sorry. Yeah, I know what Tufts is.
No, our listeners may confuse that.
I'm sorry that I don't pronounce things the way you do, Mr. Canadian.
It's a university.
Yes.
Okay, will you let me finish the story?
Yes.
Go for it.
Okay, so the op-ed piece questioned whether Scaramucci should have an advisory role at the Fletcher School of Law and Diplomacy. Scaramucci's lawyer last week sent a cease and desist letter to the student and to the newspaper demanding a formal retraction of what he claimed were false and defamatory statements. So in other Scaramucci news, I'm sure that a number of you all out there heard what he said this
morning.
Sam,
play our Scaramucci news.
Yeah, please do.
It sounds remarkably like
a
bolt on lightning. Very, very.
Mooch, moochy, moochy. Moochy, 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 mooch.
So he actually defended. So the big news today was that he defended Trump calling Elizabeth Warren Pocahontas during an event yesterday at the Native American World War II veterans event at the White House. He said that he was justified in making this comment given the context of the relationship between Elizabeth Warren and Trump. He also praised Sarah Huckabee Sanders for her efforts to protect the president while also telling the truth.
There's too much Sarah Huckabee Sanders in already in the grab bag.
It is reported that Oscar Pistorius' prison sentence was more than doubled. It's now 13 years and 5 months. This is after the murder of girlfriend Reva Steenkamp.
Good riddance, man. Rotten jail, Blade Runner. That's his nickname, the Blade Runner. I wish he like his arms were gone too. This guy deserves to rot in hell. I mean, I hate to just. What do we have? Is that?
Be careful what you say.
Pistorius. Wow. Pistorius is in the studio. He didn't know I was in the bathroom either. That's his thing. Because remember, he shot his girlfriend Valentine's Day 2013 four times through a closed toilet cubicle door with his 9mm pistol. He claimed that he thought she was an intruder. He was initially convicted of manslaughter. He got a 6-year sentence, which was declared too lenient. And now a judge has given him 13 years and 5 months, which is, in my opinion, still way too short. He has to serve at least 7 years before considered for parole. This is, of course, in South Africa.
How don't you get life?
Right?
Come on.
Yeah. I mean,
I agree.
Ridiculous. And, you know, I just hate this guy, honestly. Like, I followed the trial, and he was crying uncontrollably during the whole trial and putting on this whole act. I mean, go away, Pistorius, and again, maybe you'll lose some other parts of your body, hopefully in prison. There he is again. Pistorius, play us out. There you go. That's only three.
Oh, right, yeah, there were more than that.
More.
Okay. Charles Manson, who has passed away in the last month, he has left his entire estate to a pen pal. Very
speaking
strange
of crazy murderers.
Yes, so I was just going to say, speaking of bloodshed on Legal Face-Off. So this
Helter
story
Skelter.
Is actually.
Can you get us a little Helter Skelter?
Yeah, can we start singing Helter Skelter? You guys did
can
a great rendition of Bohemian Rhapsody. So last Friday,
Charles
so
Manson stole this song away from the Beatles. I'm stealing it back. The song is that's my Bono impersonation.
As done through Casey Kasem.
Yes.
Okay. So this is actually a very interesting story because it's taken an interesting turn since it originally broke last week. So last week, the news broke that Charles Manson had left his estate to a longtime pen pal who had allegedly been writing with Manson
what an estate,
for like
by
20
the way.
Years.
What could he have that's of any value? like a bunch of shims.
Well, apparently he's got like a music collection, and he was so kind to leave his body to
his
pen pal.
That stuff would get a lot of money. I mean, imagine like getting his property. That stuff goes for a lot.
Yes, and so the latest on this story is that there are actually now two different people claiming that Manson left his estate to them. Matthew Roberts was purportedly given a will through one of Manson's friends in January of this year.
Is that his pen pal?
No, that's his. That's the other guy who's trying to claim that he has a right to Manson's estate. And so Roberts claims that his mother told him in 1998 that Manson was his father. So it's been reported that Roberts and Ben Gorecki, who was Manson's friend who gave Roberts the will, are planning to go claim Manson's body this week and bury him. And it looks like Roberts is planning to put up a fight, especially if the pen pal shows up and wants to stake a claim to Manson's estate. So stay tuned on this one.
I love my favorite part of the Manson, like, last 50 years or 40 years.
Because it's been such a great 40, 50 years with, like, Charles Manson.
And actually, I got to steal this from Dennis Miller, but Dennis Miller does a great thing on Manson where he's like, yeah, you know, Charles Manson showed up for his probation hearing again, or his probation hearing. And he's like, what better way to signal to the board that you've gotten your life together and you're ready to hit the streets again than showing up with a swastika gouged in your forehead?
It started as an X. Yeah. I guess X marks the spot, and then it morphed into a swastika,
which is awful.
Bye-bye.
All right, miss you, Manson, though.
Our last topic on Legal Face-Off on the Grab Bag involves Naya Rivera.
Glee.
The Glee star. New details.
You know how much I love Glee, right?
You are a big Glee head.
I love the Glee.
So she was charged with a misdemeanor domestic battery after she allegedly hit her husband, Ryan Dorsey, while they were taking their son for a walk. But now there are new details with the arrest.
Well, he says that his wife's drinking is out of control. That's according to the 911 call. According to our sources here on Legal Face-Off.
Which are very reliable.
Yes, audio from Saturday night, this past Saturday, in Chesapeake, West Virginia. Ryan Dorsey sounds frightened and frantic on the phone, and he says his wife's out of control. He goes on to say that she was getting physical. He said that his father was there with him, and then the call drops. And then subsequently, as Sam mentioned, she was arrested for domestic battery. She busted his bottom lip, allegedly. She was released on a $1,000 bond. He did not go to the hospital. But yet another story of the Glee kids gone wrong. I wish there was more. I'm just making that up.
No, actually, I thought there were some issues with other folks on Glee. Didn't one unfortunately commit suicide, I thought?
That was on the show. You're talking about a storyline.
No, I thought it actually happened to somebody in real life.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Oh,
well, no, but Corey Monteith.
Yeah, you're right. Now, Corey Monteith killed him, either OD'd or killed himself. And then one of the guys, Puckerman, was arrested for child porn. So you're right. There is a it's the typical child star, you know.
This is like issues. The 21st century version of Different Strokes.
Favorite Glee character, Tina?
Didn't watch it.
There you go.
And no, I'm proud of it.
Oh, am I the only one in the room that loves me some Glee?
I just want to play with the gun.
Oh, here we go.
Oh, no.
Isn't that incredible?
Give it up.
That is so good. You guys didn't want to use that either. I think it added a lot.
No,
to
but
our
now
show.
You're now it's going to show up in every show. I'm sure.
Last November show. Sam, any
happy
Thanksgiving
belated,
stories?
Happy belated.
We should have done the legal Thanksgiving stories.
We should have. Yeah, the legal turkey.
Some good.
Darn, I'm sure there's some turkey gone wrong
CFL,
out there somewhere.
Did you enjoy the Grey Cup?
Argos, Mark Trestman.
Gray?
Yeah, Mark Trestman. Yeah,
again. Finally won a championship. Ricky Ray,
another champ.
Three Grey Cups.
It's a nice story. Did I miss anything on the show? This is the last one before we get to December.
Yeah.
Yeah. I think you did a great job this time, Sammy.
All right, perfect.
Next show on the eve of Hanukkah.
For Rich Lenkov and Tina Martini, my name is Sam Panionovich. Thanks to Craig Collins and all of our guests. If you missed anything, hit the rewind button or just re-download the show, WGNradio.com. Search for Legal Face-Off on iTunes. We'll talk to you next month.